lots of other people, so no self-promotion for now. The number field sieve, I think you've heard about several factoring algorithms last week, the row method and the P-1 method, the elliptic curve method.
Dan Bernstein, Lecture 1.
How people factor large integers, particularly large integers that are designed to be hard to factor. Of course, most integers you just divide by 2, 3, 5, and hey, you're probably going to find a factor. But if an integer is designed to be hard to factor, then the records are set by the number field sieve. This is the fastest way that we have to find large prime factors of large integers. How does the number field sieve work? Well, that's the topic for today. I want to tell you what the number field sieve computes, give you some feeling for why that computation frequently, most of the time, factors large numbers in a certain amount of time. I'm not going to get too much into how fast the number field sieve is until subsequent talks. So let me jump in with a special case of the number field sieve, the special case of the Q-sieve. All I've done here is I've written down a type of computation you've already heard about, seen many times before this summer school, I'm sure, of sieving small integers with the sieve of Eratosthenes. I've written down the integers from 1 through 20, that's the first column here, and then every second integer I've marked with a 2. 2 and 4 and 6 and 8 and 10 and so on are all divisible by 2. And I've also marked in the next column the integers divisible by 4. I've put another 2 there for 2 times 2. Every fourth integer, 4 is 2 times 2. Whoops, that might mean I should. Okay. Thank you, Andreas. Who's playing with the lights? Okay, so 4 and 8 and 12 and so on all have a second 2. And then 16, oh, okay, marked another 2 for multiples of 8. And then another 2 for multiples of 16 and stop at that point because, well, there's nothing here divisible by 2 to the 5th. And then I started marking which of these numbers are divisible by 3. 3, 6, 9, 12, and so on are divisible by 3. And then I also marked some 3 squared. And then 5 and 7, similarly, I marked which of these integers are divisible by 5 or divisible by 7. You can use this sieve as a prime sieve. So for instance, seeing that ignoring the 2, 3, 5, 7, which I used to begin with, 11 and 13 and 17 and 19 have nothing in their rows. So those are prime. And I continued in this way for a while, quite a bit past 20, along with starting from 611. Well, if I continued long enough past 20, I would get to 611 anyway. But I actually want to line these tables up. I started from 1 and I started from 612, or if you like, starting from 0 and 611. I wrote down the same thing where every integer between 612 and 631. I wrote down which of those are divisible by 2, and which of them are divisible by 4, wrote down another 2, and so on. And the 3s, well, 612 is divisible by 3, and then skipping by 3s, see which of these numbers, starting from 611, are divisible by 3. And same for 5 and 7. Now, what's interesting about this table, what we're going to see beyond, for instance, noticing some primes and lots of factors of these numbers, is that you can factor 611. If I had included 611 in this table, you would have seen it's not divisible by 2, 3, 5, or 7. But the Q-sieve extracts the factorization of 611 out of the information that I've shown you in these tables. This is kind of like the Bible code. You know, you look at some big long text and say, ooh, by mangling the numbers in the following way, manipulating them, I can somehow come up with, yes, I predicted that there was going to be a big bombing in 2001, et cetera, et cetera. Well, by manipulating these numbers appropriately, you can come up with a factor of 611. Let me go ahead and do that. At the bottom of this slide is a factorization, non-trivial factorization of 611. It's a 47 and 13. And how did I get the 47 and 13 out of the numbers that I know? Well, by lining up the tables here, the 1 and 612 lined up, the 2 and 613, and so on, I've gotten some congruences modulo 611. What I've written down here is I times 611 plus I. That's something I'm going to call a congruence. What you should be thinking is I is congruent to 611 plus I, modulo 611. For instance, 1 congruent to 612, 2 congruent to 613, etc. And if I continue for a while, as I did, I got 14 times 625, which you can see here. I actually went for about 100 numbers and found some more examples, 64 congruent to 675, 75 congruent to 686. Those are congruences that are completely factored. From the table that I wrote down here, you can see some of these, like 625, 5 times 5 times 5 times 5. If you multiply that out, or divide 625 by 4 5s, you see that you've completely factored 625 into small primes. And similarly, 14 is exactly 2 times 7. Some other numbers are not completely factored into small primes. For instance, 13 There's no small primes listed there. But there's definitely numbers that are completely factored, that are smooth. You've heard that terminology last week. 14 is 2 times 7. And 625 is 5 to the 4th. And these line up. 14 is congruent to 625. Both of them are completely factored. In other words, the congruence 14 times 625 is 2 to the something, 3 to the something, 5 to the something, 7 to the something. 2 to the 1, 3 to the 0, 5 to the 4, 7 to the 1. Similarly, I found some more rows that were completely factored, some more congruences, mod 611. And by multiplying those together, interestingly, I came up with a square. From the left side here, I've just repeated 14 times 625, 64 times 675, 75 times 686. And then by adding up the exponents, 2 to the 1 times 2 to the 6 times 2 to the 1 is 2 to the 8th. And same for power 3, power 5, power 7. I ended up with a square. Each of the exponents is even. Now, by taking the square root of that, 2 to the 4th, 3 squared, 5 to the 4th, 7 squared, subtracting that from the product of the i's in these congruences, I times 611 plus I, by subtracting those numbers and then taking the greatest common divisor with 611, which is a very easy computation by Euclid's algorithm, as you've already heard, I ended up with 47. This difference of two random-looking numbers, the product 14 times 64 times 75, and this square root of 14 times 625 times 64 times 675, etc., that difference happens to have a factor in common with 611. 611 is 47, that common factor, times 13.
So you ignored all the factors greater than 7.
Yeah, I started by deciding I was going to work with 2, 3, 5, and 7, and then I didn't think about other factorizations here, like 11 I know is completely factored as, well, 11, but I'm not using the prime 11 in this computation. All right, the reasonable question to ask about this, is this a Bible code situation? Is this something where just by manipulating numbers for long enough, if you start with 611 and take greatest common divisors with random numbers, then hey, maybe you'll find a 47, 147th of the time, and you'll find a 13, 113th of the time, and so you'll factor 611, something like 147th plus 113th minus 1 over 611 of the time. And if you're preparing a talk and doing a lot of computations, you can afford to do hundreds of computations until you get one that magically works out. But this is not one of those situations. This was actually unsurprising that this GCD has a factor in common with 611. And here's, well, as I stated on the slide, was it just blind luck? GCD of 611 and some random number being 47 could have happened by accident, but this was not an accident. Let me give a name to S is the product of the I's in the congruences, and T is the product, well, it's the square root of the I times N plus I's, N being 611. Then N divides S squared minus T squared. If I look at S squared, that's 14 squared, 64 squared, 75 squared. That's almost exactly what I wrote down here. It's exactly this, mod 611. Mod 611, this square of t, t squared is equal to 14 times 625 times et cetera. That's s squared, mod 611. So s squared minus t squared, s squared is congruent to t squared, mod 611. In other words, if you take 14 congruent to 625, multiply that by 64 congruent to 675, multiply that by 75 congruent to 686, then you end up with a square congruent to a square, namely the square of s, congruent to the square of t. All right, knowing that n divides s squared minus t squared tells us about the primes dividing n that, well, they have to all also divide s squared minus t squared. I've said here each prime greater than 7. I'll get back to why I'm excluding the 2, 3, 5, 7 here. Each prime dividing n certainly divides s squared minus t squared, which is s minus t times s plus t. And now I said it actually divides either s minus t or s plus t. You can't divide both, and that's because if it divided both, it would have to divide t, or 2t by adding these, and 2t is 2, 3, 5, 7. If you have a prime bigger than 7, then it can't be a divisor of 2t, and therefore it can't be a divisor of both, s minus t and s plus t. So now if we don't, I should have written on the slide n here, 611. Anyway, each of the primes dividing 611, which a priori we don't know about, has to divide s minus t or s plus t. And if we don't have any other information, then it's kind of random whether a prime divides S minus T or S plus T. We could have replaced T by minus T, say, and all the other algebra here would have worked out. Exchanging these, the prime doesn't really know which of those it's going to divide. Okay, this is getting beyond mathematics into philosophy, but it's not such a surprise. If S and T were uniform random units modulo n that had the same squares, then there would be a chance of exactly 50% for any particular prime to divide S minus T. So it's not surprising, although, again, there's no proofs here, there's no guarantees before doing the computation. It's not terribly surprising. Half the time we do these computations, a particular prime, any particular prime dividing n, divides S minus T, while another prime decides to divide S plus T. And that's what happened here. 47 decided to divide S minus T, while 13 divided S plus T. So by taking the greatest common divisor, as in Dixon's random squares method that you heard about last week, you end up with a factorization of 611. Question?
Those three I's that you found, are those all of the I's that fit the algorithm you're doing?
Are those all of the I's that fit? Within the first 100, I think so. I stopped the computation after that. If you keep going, then I guess theoretically you would expect that there will be infinitely many, but it kind of spreads out. I'll get back to the question of how frequent these are. It's a reasonable question of are these all the I's. Certainly within the range that I tried, they were kind of sparse, so I had to look for a while before finding that first example. That was the only one in my table of the first 20 I's. And then the 64 and 75, I had to look quite a while for. Certainly would not want to put that table on the screen. And there was nothing between 1 and 75, aside from that. Okay. You might ask why, by taking those first three I's, you've heard about this issue in Dixon's method as well. If you have some completely factored congruences and you multiply them together, there's no reason to expect that you should get a square. In my case, I took 14 times 625, 64 times etc., and multiplied those three together. Those were the first three I's I found. I guess that's what you're asking. And by multiplying them together, I magically got a square. There was no guarantee of that. This was just blind luck that I came up with a square. In other words, by adding these three vectors, which you might recognize as before, I had 2 to the 1, 3 to the 0, 5 to the 4, 7 to the 1, and same for these other two vectors, by adding those vectors up, I happened to get even numbers, 0 modulo 2, in each coordinate. It was 8 comma something comma something comma something, which you can see by adding these up. And that was just luck. As you write down vectors that are longer and longer, it becomes increasingly unlikely for this luck to happen. However, you don't have to worry about that. If you have any number of components of your vectors, any length of your vector, then provided you have enough vectors, you will find some subsequence of them, not the trivial one of the empty subsequence. You'll find some non-trivial subsequence of those vectors, which has some 0 mod 2. In other words, if you have a bunch of complete factorizations, then you will find some subset, some non-empty subset of those, that has a square product. And that's just because you do linear algebra, which, again, I believe you heard about all this in the quadratic sieve random squares method. I'll be saying much more about the speed of this computation, but just as an example of finding a subset with square product, I tried doing the same thing. Instead of factoring 611 with the Q sieve, I tried factoring 671, and I wrote down 1 times n plus 1, happened to factor nicely, 4 times n plus 4, kept going for a while, and after getting up to 64, I had 5 factorizations into 4 small primes. 5 complete factorizations of numbers I times n plus I into products of powers of 2, 3, 5, and 7. And once you have more vectors than components in your vectors, you're guaranteed to have, by linear algebra, a dependency, an element of the kernel of the matrix, an element of the null space of the matrix of exponents there. If you look at 5101, 2320, 1113, and so on, then those vectors are linearly dependent modulo 2. And in fact, they're linearly dependent over the real numbers without even a mod 2, but we're satisfied with even numbers. We don't need to have zeros as sums or differences of these things. You can find a subset of these, of the exponents, that add up to even numbers. And I just did some linear algebra. I told, maybe it was GP, to take 5101, 2320, and so on, modulo 2, to tell me the kernel of that matrix. And it told me very quickly that, well, the kernel is generated by these vectors of length 5 shown here. These are dual vectors, column vectors. The way you should read these, when you see 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, that means take one of these, 0 of these, 1 of these, 1 of these, 0 of those. If you multiply the first and the third and the fourth together, you get an even number. And that's an easy computation, and the complete kernel, the only ways that you can get even numbers by adding up subsets of the exponent vectors that you see here is by taking the first, third, fourth, or the second, fourth, fifth, or a combination of these, taking, I guess, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, that will also give you a square. For example, 1 times n plus 1 times 15 times n plus 15 times 49 times n plus 49 is a square. All right, that is a doable computation, and no matter how big your vectors are, it's not terribly painful to do that computation. Again, I'll get back to the speed of all this and the fanciest methods that people use later on. All right, we believe, although nobody can prove anything, we believe that this algorithm, the Q-sieve, will factor every integer into prime factors. Well, okay, it won't separate prime powers. You have to look specially for prime powers. It also won't handle 2 very well, but it will take any integer n and separate factor n completely, if you keep going with the Q-sieve, into products of powers of odd primes, assuming you factored out the 2s to begin with. For instance, 611 and 671 succeeded at factorizations eventually. I don't remember actually if I completed this particular computation, if this one gave me a factorization of 671. 50-50 chance figure for each of these generators of the kernel that I try. Same thing seems to happen for every n, although we can't prove it, that every n gets factored into products of powers of odd primes along with whatever 2s that you factor out separately. Here's the complete algorithm for any integer n. You take all I's between 1 and, say, y squared. Last week you heard something about smoothness, and the y squared there is some analytic smoothness thing that I'll discuss in more detail. It doesn't matter that it's a square. It's just something bigger than y. Y here is the limit on primes. For instance, y equals 7 that I used before. Primes 2, 3, 5, 7. In general, you pick some y, scaling appropriately with n, and you look at all the primes less than or equal to y, try dividing them into all these I times n plus I's, where I runs from 1 through, say, y squared. Again, I'll try varying the 2 later. We'll see what effect that has on the analysis. You try completely factoring I times n plus I's, which means you have to throw away a lot of I's where it doesn't completely factor into these small primes. The congruences I times n plus I are not products of powers of primes less than or equal to y. But then you do have some where they are completely factored. And then, by linear algebra, find a subset which gives a square. Find a set of i's such that the product of I times n plus I is a square, a non-empty set of i's. Finally, take s and t, defined in the same way as before. S is the product of the i's, and t is the square root of the square that you just found by linear algebra. The difference, s minus t, has a pretty good chance of factoring n, at least intuitively. S squared minus t squared is 0 mod n. So any prime dividing n has a 50-50 chance of dividing s minus t or not. All right, so we believe that every n will find a square subset after a reasonable amount of time, and we believe that these differences are not going to conspire to always have a greatest common divisor with n of 1 or n. This does seem to always work.
In both your examples, you have to go further than y squared.
That's true. However, what I did in my example is I took y equals 10.
Okay.
Thanks, Rev. The question of exactly how far you have to go, this is a serious one. If you choose y to be too small, then suddenly it's not reasonable to imagine this will work. Before I generalize to the number field sieve, I would like to say something about how you choose y and how likely this is to succeed, building on what you heard about smoothness last week. All right, so how big does this y have to be? That's the first question, is how do you choose this parameter y? And yeah, if I had chosen y equals 7, then I don't think the factorizations of 611 and 671 would have worked. But with y equals 10, it does work. And as y gets bigger and bigger, well, it's easy to see that as y gets really big, suddenly the method is practically guaranteed to work, at least intuitively. Again, we can't prove anything. But let's have as a goal for guaranteeing that the algorithm will work, remember from linear algebra, if we're looking at the exponent vectors in these I times n plus i's, if there are more vectors than the length of the exponent vectors, the these exponent vectors are, for instance, for 2, 3, 5, 7, there's four components in each vector. And in general, for primes less than or equal to y, well, there's however many primes there are up through y, that's the number of components in each vector. And let's try to choose y big enough that the number of vectors, the number of completely factored congruences, I times n plus I, is more than the number of primes less than or equal to y. Actually, if you do computations, you see this is overkill for y, but it's not serious overkill. This will give you a somewhat pessimistic idea of how fast the Q-sieve is, but let's just take this pessimistic model and see how long we need to go to get that guarantee that the Q-sieve will find a square, which still doesn't mean that the last step will work, but we believe the last step works. We've never seen an n that's immune to the Q-sieve. The number of primes up through y is about y over log y, prime number theorem. And the question now about y, to choose y so that we have this guarantee of finding a square, the question is, are we choosing y big enough that out of the first y squared choices of i's from 1, 2, 3 through y squared, are there going to be more than the number of primes, which I'm just approximating by y over log y, completely factored congruence? That's a question about smoothness that you have already heard the answer to. To remind you of the definition, y smooth is, well, product of powers of primes less or equal to y, no prime factors bigger than y. So rephrasing the question here, how many of these congruences, out of y squared congruences, how many of them are y smooth? For example, suppose we take y to be the 10th root of n, n being the number we're trying to factor. Then experimental fact, and here there actually are some theorems as n goes to infinity, if you take an integer between, let's first take 1 through y squared, I'm thinking of I is a random number between 1 and y squared. The chance of I being y smooth is about 30%. That is actually a theorem as n goes to infinity, converges to 30%. And, well, I think you've seen lots of tables now, smoothness probabilities, and we can prove some things about this. An integer between 1 and n, I'm thinking of n plus I here, and okay, here this jumps beyond what we could prove. N plus I maybe doesn't have the right smoothness chances compared to an integer between 1 and n. But still, experimentally, we observe that an integer between 1 and y to the 10th, y is about the 10th root of n, so n is y to the 10th, an integer in that range has about, what is that, 1 in 10 to the 10th, 1 in 10 to the 11th chance of being smooth. You might believe that the smoothness chance of I times n plus I is about the product of these two numbers, 30% and 2.77%. And this is beyond not just what we can prove, but what's actually true. But it's still the right ballpark. It's something like 8.5 times 10 to the minus 12 chance. If you write down a random number I between 1 and y, where y is about the 10th root of n, that's what's giving these numbers, is I'm choosing y to be the 10th root of n, then the smoothness chance of I times n plus I is this constant, 8.5 times 10 to the minus 12, no matter how big n is. And that means that out of i's between 1 and y squared, we expect that something like 10 to the minus 12 of them, a total of 10 to the minus 12 times y squared integers, will be completely factored. We'll have I times n plus I being smooth. Easy calculation on your calculator, if you have n being bigger than, well, 2 to the 340 is about right, and y is about the 10th root of n, then this y squared times a small constant, 8.5 10 to the minus 12 y squared, the number of y smooth I times n plus i's that we come up with, that's run quadratically, and it grows faster than 3y over log y. What's that 3 doing there? Good question. I think the 3 is just to say, wow, we've got many more of the... why did I put the 3 there? I'm thinking to retroactively justify it, that it's... this is, again, overkill that we're guaranteeing here. This is 8.5 times 10 to the minus 12 y squared. That's the number of y smooth integers out of y squared possibilities. And then that's bigger than 3 times the number of primes up through y. That's certainly big enough for the Q-sieve to find a square. The conjecture here is the conjecture that as n gets bigger and bigger, there aren't any n's where the I times n plus i's conspire to not be smooth, which is possible, but, we've tried a lot of n's and it always seems to work. If you write down a few more fully factored congruences, if you keep going for a few more i's than the first I where you find a square, then you actually find a bunch of squares. Every new I, pretty much, certainly for the guarantee of success, if you have the number of vectors you write down being the number of components in each vector plus 10, that guarantees that you'll have 10 independent squares. And, well, each of those gives a 50-50 chance of factoring your integer. So you just try one, and if the greatest common divisor is 1 or 611 or whatever n was, then you keep going onto the next square, and very quickly after finding the first square, you find a factorization of n. Conjecturally, this always works. Every integer n seems to be factored. So how fast was this? Can we choose y better?
Well, I went to the n to the 1/10.
Yeah, well, that n to the 1/10 was just an example that once n is big enough, bigger than 2 to the 340, that's already into cryptographic ranges, that cryptographic numbers you might want to factor would be 512 bits, well, I hope nobody's using those anymore, 1024 bits, maybe 1536 or 2048. Those are bigger than 2 to the 340, and then if y is n to the 1/10, then all the computations I've talked about, which as we'll see take a total amount of effort, number of bit operations is something like y squared, y cubed. We'll get into that in more detail. That's n to the 1/10 to the square or cube, maybe. It's a small power of n. It's less than square root of n. It's less than the time you would need for trial division. And, well, okay, I'm going to worry more about speed later. And the fact that these methods are more effective than the number field sieve, which I'm building towards, is more effective than, say, the quadratic sieve or the elliptic curve method for finding big factors of integers, that's something that we'll see in a lot more detail. Coming back to your other question about if we take y to be the uth root of n instead of the 10th root of n, well, yeah, you could choose u however you want, and then instead of that 8.5 times 10 to the minus 12, you get something on the scale of u to the minus u. And you've already heard more about that than what I'm going to need for understanding the performance of these algorithms. So here's a plausible conjecture based on that. If you take n bigger than, instead of 2 to the 340, it's something like u to the u squared. 10 to the 100, maybe? Well, there's a 1 plus little o of 1 here. Little o of 1 means something that converges to 0 as n goes to infinity. And it's actually kind of hard to write down exactly what the little o of 1 is. But there's some bound for n, where once n is past that, say u to the u squared, then choosing y to be about the uth root of n makes the q sieve work. If you look at the smoothness chances, then conjecturally and experimentally, the Q sieve does succeed in factoring n. Turning around that choice of y, saying instead of choosing a u and then figuring out y from n to the 1 over u, how about we'll just figure out the best y by trying? Y equals 7, y equals 10, y equals, they keep going up in, say, geometric progression, multiply by 1.4, multiply by 2 each time until the Q sieve works. That always seems to work, that eventually we get to some y where the Q sieve succeeds in factoring n. And turning around that u to the u squared formula, if you ask how big should u be, which we'll determine by just trying a bunch of y's, how big should y be, if you look at the u to the u squared and think, okay, what's the smallest u where, exactly the right u where this inequality is going to work, and so that would be the largest u that makes this inequality true, and then plug that into y, then you end up seeing something like this formula, that the y is about e to the square root of 1/2 log n log log n. Again, there's a little o of 1 here, something that converges to 0 as n goes to infinity, and the conjecture that it converges to 0 is much more believable than any specific conjecture about what that little o of 1 is. It's very hard to work out the little o of 1s in these analyses. The u, if you turn around that n equals u to the u squared, you get u is about this square root of 2 log n over log log n, which I think you also heard about formulas like this last week, then that will make the q sieve work. Once y gets to be about this big, then the q sieve succeeds in factoring n. Everything that happens in the q sieve takes polynomial time with respect to y. It's some power of y, which we'll look at in more detail, but let's say it's y cubed. Then the total time for the Q sieve is going to be this e to the square root of 1/2 log n log log n to the third. In other words, e to the square root of 9/2 log n log log n, the 3 getting squared when I put it inside the square root. The cost of the Q sieve grows sub-exponentially, like the quadratic sieve and the Dixon's random squares method, which has the virtue that we can actually prove these theorems. And the elliptic curve method also has this kind of flavor of being e to the square root of something log n log log n. This is something sub-exponential. It's not quite the simplest sub-exponential time algorithm for factoring in, but it has the virtue of building up to the number field SID, which I think I'm getting to next. Yes, a little bit of variability first. I said we're going to go up to y squared. And it doesn't have to be y squared. It could be up to y to the something. The c there is not the something. Instead of y squared, if you go up to y to the c plus 1, then it looks like for an appropriate choice of y, the q-sieve is going to work. You can vary the q-sieve, change the y squared to say y cubed. And you go through all the same analysis, work out the smoothness probabilities, approximate conjecture, guess experiment, and you decide at the end of the day that the y smoothness chance, all starting from the same u to the minus u formula you've heard for the chance of a number with number about the size of n being smooth up to n to the 1 over u, if you go through those formulas and turn them around into the speed of the algorithm, you eventually end up with here's how many i's you need for an appropriate choice of y. If you, instead of y squared, have y to the c plus 1, and then you turn around the analysis into how big should y be, then you see the number of i's you need is e to the square root of this c plus 1 squared over 2c. If c is 1, for instance, that should give 2 squared over 2. That's the same e to the square root of 2. Did I get this backwards? C plus 1 squared, sorry, if c is 0, then I'm getting awfully confused about my formulas. If c is 1, that was the y squared that I had before. Let's try this. 1 plus 1. Anybody? 2 squared is 4 divided by 2. That sounds like e to the square root of 2 log n log log n. Now that's supposed to be the same as the y squared that we had before. If y looks like e to the square root of 1 half, what's going on? Ah, that's the y, is e to the square root of 1 half, and then y squared will be e to the square root of 2 log n log log n. That's the number of i's you have to look at, is e to the square root of 2 log n log log n for the q-sieve to work. And, well, then you can vary c, and it turns out the y squared case, c equals 1, is optimal. That e to the square root of c plus 1 squared over 2c, this minimizes the number of i's you have to look at. If you increase c past 1, if you tried c equals 1.1 or 2, so you have, instead of going up to y squared, instead of trying y squared congruences, try y cubed congruences, then the number of congruences you have to look at, the number of i's, goes up even after you optimize y. Again, let me emphasize that when you increase y squared up to y cubed, you can decrease y to compensate, and that's what gives this complicated formula at the end of the day. The advantage of increasing this number of i's, of looking at more and more congruences, is that actually, because y is smaller, the cost of the linear algebra is smaller. If you choose your y properly, for any particular choice of the y squared, if you choose y and choose the c accordingly, if you optimize your parameters, then you can always make your linear algebra as small as possible inside the number field sieve, in this case, the q-sieve computation. But the same is true for all these other algorithms, the quadratic sieve, the number field sieve. These algorithms never really depend on the cost of linear algebra. We're going to look at how the fastest linear algebra works, and that will dictate how the best y's should be chosen. But it's more important to look at the cost of recognizing smooth numbers, recognizing which of those I times n plus i's are y smooth, which is going to be the topic of my second talk. I'm going to go through the methods you've seen and some more methods, getting you to the state of the art and figuring out which numbers are smooth. And then you do linear algebra, which again can be balanced with the cost of finding the smooth numbers in the first place. All right, so there's that variation on the q-sieve. And oops, I'm still not up to the number field sieve. Let me point out this sublattices idea. Yeah, I have time to talk about this. Sublattices are a way to adapt the q-sieve and also the number field sieve that we'll see later to improve the smoothness chances of the numbers you write down. If you look at that I times n plus I, then I said, well, the chance of that being smooth is about, the chance of I being smooth is whatever, chance of n plus I being smooth is about whatever. Overall, it's about u to the minus u. If y is n to the 1 over u, then I times n plus I has about a u to the minus u chance of being y smooth. But if you look at different sizes of I, then that smoothness chance gets worse. If I gets bigger, the smoothness chance gets smaller. If you look at I equals 1, 1 times n plus 1, it's n plus 1. That's small compared to, say, y squared times n plus y squared. That's bigger than n by a factor of y squared. And bigger numbers are less likely to be smooth. So the smoothest chance drops. Here's this crude analysis that, yeah, if I is, for instance, about y, there's about y congruences between, for instance, I equals y and I equals 2y. And for those, I times n plus I is about y, or 2y, times n. If I is much bigger, if I is around y squared, which is many more of the congruences, then the size of I times n plus I is about y squared times n. Well, y squared times n plus y squared, then n's going to be much bigger than y, because y grows sub-exponentially in n, for instance, n to the 1/10. If you look at the pieces of I and n plus I, and you ask separately for each of those, what's the chance of that being smooth, then, okay, n plus I, if I goes from 1 up through y to the, from 1 up to n to the 2/10, for example, then it basically makes no difference in the size of n plus that. N plus 1 versus n plus the fifth root of n is almost exactly the same number in terms of how big it is, what its log is. But I gets a lot bigger. I goes from 1 up through, say, n to the n to the 2/10, or generally y squared, and the smoothness chance of I, when I is as big as y squared, is only about 30%, that number I mentioned before. In other words, as I gets bigger from y to y squared, you get a drop in your smoothness count. Certainly if I is very small, it's guaranteed to be smooth. Can we look at some I's, instead of just looking at 1 through y squared, can we look at I's so that the drop in smoothness chances does not happen? The answer turns out to be yes. The basic trick is to look, instead of at I times n plus I, to try to divide out some q, which is a square. And if we multiply and divide all of our squares by squares, then it doesn't matter. They're still squares. So choose a q, top of the slide here. Choose a square q. Take a prime bigger than y, and take q to be the square of that prime. You can also work with q's that are non-squares with more effort in what you do later on. But let's just take q to be a square. So again, multiplying and dividing things by q is not going to change whether something's a square. I'll define a q sublattice of the i's as a lattice where, well, arithmetic progression, we're just looking at one-dimensional objects, an arithmetic progression of integers I, such that for each of those i's in the arithmetic progression, q divides I times n plus I. For example, the simplest way to do this, well, is this quite the simplest? You could have i's being multiple to q. Here's the second simplest way to do this. You could take I to be q minus n mod q, or 2q minus n mod q, or 3q minus n mod q, and plugging those into I times n plus I, what do we get? Let's see, I times n plus q minus n mod q, I claim that's a multiple of q. Q minus n mod q plus n, yeah, that's a multiple of q. And same for adding q to each of those i's, we get q dividing I times n plus I. So, within this sublattice, I times n plus I, by construction, each of those n plus i's is divisible by q. Or whatever strategy we use to choose an arithmetic progression, I times n plus I will, by construction, be divisible by q, which makes the product I times n plus I divided by q smaller, and therefore more likely to be smooth. Constant theme in these factorization algorithms that combine congruences is we want to have the smallest possible numbers that we hope are smooth. For example, again, for I being q minus n mod q, 2q minus n mod q, etc., we check whether I and n plus I over q are smooth. And that's more likely to happen than I and n plus I without the q there being chance of whether those are smooth if I is just a random number, not chosen to have n plus I being divisible by a square. You can do this not just for one square, but for a bunch of squares. As I say at the bottom here, try a bunch of q's. It's unusual to see the same I twice. You don't have to worry about seeing the same I again. And then you put together all the I's that you find where I times n plus I over q is smooth, and then try to find subsets where products of those are squares exactly as before. Think of an example again. If n is the following random number generated by my computer, 314159J6E. You might think my computer's random number generator is broken. Actually, the State Department, I have this nice new ThinkPad, Lenovo ThinkPad. It's got this titanium cover, all sorts of cool features that you didn't see in ThinkPads before. It's also made by Lenovo, a Chinese company. And the United States State Department has now prohibited Lenovo laptops from coming into the State Department building. Because they actually say they think that the Chinese government has put bugs into into these ThinkPads. And maybe they've also modified the random number generators that people are using in cryptography. So anyway, I generated a random number out of my computer, and I didn't see any problem at all. It's just random, 6141592653589209323. And that turns out not to be prime. Actually, it's an interesting problem for those of you who have seen this level of the number field sieve before I ramp up the difficulty and generalize to the real number field sieve. You might like to factor that number. Here's some examples of what the QSIV does with this number. It writes down 1 and n plus 1, 2 and n plus 2, 3 and n plus 3. And you can see how big those numbers are and estimate how likely those are to be, say, 1,000 smooth, if y is 1,000. Instead of looking at those numbers, you can look at, say, here's Q. It's 987 squared, which is 994009. Look at all the integers I that are congruent to 802458 plus 997 squared times an integer. For each of those, by construction, I chose that 802458 so that n plus that number would be divisible by Q, by 997 squared. And for these I's, in this arithmetic progression, I know that n plus I is divisible by 997 squared, and dividing it out, I get a substantially smaller number, more likely to be smooth. And okay, also the I has to be smooth, but hopefully the chance of both of those happening doesn't degrade as badly as here, as I gets bigger and bigger. Let's see how bad this degradation is. You might do, as before, a crude analysis where you look at how big I times n plus I are, I times n plus I is for the various I's, or you can do a careful analysis where you look at how big I is, how big n plus I is. I said, again, multiplying those probabilities is not exactly right. It's not just a question of proof. There's a correlation between smoothness chances of I and n plus I. For instance, if n is odd, then if 2 divides I, it's not going to divide n plus I. But anyway, those are minor effects compared to the whole u to the minus u philosophy that kicks in as n gets bigger and bigger. If you look at just the size of I times n plus I over Q, where I is chosen as before, let's just take one first number for each Q. Take I being Q minus n mod Q. Don't even go any further in this arithmetic progression. Then I times n plus I over Q, where Q is a square as before, that is a number which is just as good as the original I times n plus I's for the Q sieve, and it's always between 0 and n. Look at how big this is. It's Q times n something divided by Q. Well, work it out carefully. It's always between 0 and n, taking account of the n minus 1 and so on. You can see this number is always not growing. It's never degrading in how big it is, and therefore it's never degrading in smoothness chance. According to the crude analysis, where you look at how big I times n plus I over Q is, if you look carefully at the I and the n plus I, then you see actually this is an improvement over the Q sieve. It makes numbers somewhat smaller, not enough to change the overall e to the square root of 2 log n log log n, but enough to noticeably improve the little o of 1, to improve the performance by something like a log n factor. If you look carefully at the chance of I being smooth, well, how big is I? If you choose Q to be about the square root of n, then I is going to be, if you take I to be Q minus n mod Q, that's about the square root of n, some random number between 0 and Q. And n plus I over Q is also about that big, about the square root of n. Instead of, as before, we had I being really small, between 1 and y squared, where y is really small, and n plus I being really big, about the size of n, which is about y to the u. Now we're looking at two numbers, which are both about square root of n, in other words, y to the u over 2 size. In the example I had, as I was getting bigger, the n plus I divided by something was getting correspondingly smaller. And if you balance those, then actually the smoothness chance of the product is even better than the smoothness chance for these unbalanced numbers. Because what's the chance of something up to y to the u over 2 being y smooth? It's about u over 2 to the minus u over 2, the same u to the minus u approximation, which is good enough for this analysis. And then another factor that I've multiplied there for the chance of there's I being smooth and is n plus I over Q smooth. Those are both about y to the u over 2. Multiplying, we see that the smoothness chance is roughly 2 to the u over u to the u. This is right to within a 1 plus little o of 1 exponent. And it's noticeably better by a factor of 2 to the u than the 1 over u to the u that we had previously. In order to actually prove things, you need to do a more careful analysis. Even if you assume all sorts of randomness here, if you try to say, oh, we can improve Dixon's method, the quadratic sieve, in this way, it's hopeless to actually prove that, say, the number field sieve is improved to prove that the number field sieve is sped up by sublattices, but you can apply it and you try different ends and you see the factorization happens more quickly. So this is a lot of what happens in computational number theory is people go way beyond what we can prove and say, okay, this is something that seems to work, and hey, look, my computations got done faster. Of course, when we can prove things, that's nice. All right, I believe that the main algorithm of this type you heard about last week was the quadratic sieve, example being Dixon's method, the random squares method. If you change the I times n plus I into I squared minus n, it has all the same algebraic features of being a square mod n. If you look mod n, I squared minus n is I squared. If you look mod n, I times n plus I is I squared. Being a square mod n is all you need for these algorithms to work. The quadratic sieve has the virtue that you heard about, that if I is about the square root of n, then I squared minus n is much smaller than n. If I is very close to square root of n, then I squared minus n is about the square root of n itself, not too much bigger than I. And if you use sublattices there, it never gets bigger than the square root of n. That's the multiple polynomial quadratic sieve. If you take I squared minus n divided by q for some appropriate q's, then the size of those is about square root of n. And, well, you can look at a whole bunch of i's for a whole bunch of q's. You end up with a whole bunch of numbers about square root of n big instead of n big. Here I had two numbers about the square root of n that I wanted to have being smooth, or one number about the size of n. The quadratic sieve and the multiple polynomial version have numbers about the square root of n that they want to have being smooth. Dixon's random squares method has provability at the expense of how big these are. It has numbers that are about n by choosing I randomly, and then you can prove that the method actually works. It factors in sub-exponential time. But we're going in a different direction of, we don't care about proofs, we want the fastest possible factorizations, and that's where the number field sieve kicks in. That produces numbers that we want to have being smooth, that if enough of them are smooth, we will find a square, which hopefully is going to factor in, and half the time in practice it does. And then you can find more squares and keep trying. In the case of the number field sieve, the size of the integers that you want to have being smooth is n to the little o of 1, n to the something that converges to 0. Instead of n or square root of n, it's n to the epsilon. In practice, as n gets bigger, you eventually do see, for say, 5 12-bit numbers that have been factored, the number field sieve produces significantly smaller numbers that we want to have being smooth than the multiple polynomial quadratic sieve. So let me generalize from the Q sieve to the number field sieve. And this is what I want to do finishing off today, is tell you the algebra of what goes on in the number field sieve. Let me go back to my first example again. You remember how the Q sieve worked. I've thrown in a little twist here that instead of just I times I plus 611, I've written down I times I plus 611 J. In my examples, J was always 1. But you can do all the same stuff with any multiple of 611. They're all the same, 611. And as we generalize to the number field sieve, it becomes somewhat important to have that extra flexibility of choosing bigger J's. You can optimize the sizes of your numbers better. So let me state the Q sieve as using I plus 611J, even though we always use J equals 1. And here's the same example of 14 times 64 times 75 times 625 times 675 times 686 being a square, the square of the 2 to the 8th. 3 to the whatever that I had before. Greatest common divisor came out to 47. All right, recopy this to give you a comparison to the next example of the number field sieve is the quadratic number field sieve. For instance, the Q adjoint square root of 14 sieve. You were hearing about quadratic fields this morning, and for verifying this computation, for seeing where the numbers came from and checking that the equalities are equalities, you don't need to know anything about Q adjoint root 14, although we're going to have more algebra popping in later. If I write down a bunch of I plus 25J times I plus square root of 14J, I write down a bunch of pairs I comma J, then eventually I found a product of those I plus blah times I plus blah being a square. Specifically, I looked at a bunch of IJs and I found that here's I equals minus 11, J equals 3. If I wrote down minus 11 plus 3 times 25 times minus 11 plus 3 times square root of 14, and then multiplied that by the I plus 25J, here J is 1, I is 3, multiplied by 3 plus 25 times 3 plus root 14, then that comes out to a square. It's 112 minus 16 root 14 squared. I'm not going to factor these numbers into primes. As you go on with the number field sieve, you stop factoring numbers into primes because, as you started hearing this morning, the concept of prime factorization becomes increasingly tricky for higher and higher degree number fields. Even in quadratic fields, it's a little tricky to write down all the primes you want to work with, but we'll just ignore that and look at squares of elements, and you can easily calculate this 112 minus 16 root 14 squared and easily calculate the left side and see these are equal. And now, just as before, I mangle the numbers in such a way that I get a factor of 611. I take the product of I plus 25 j's without the square root of 14 part, multiplying those together, I call that s. Instead of the product of i's before, I take the product of the first components of these congruences. Minus 11 plus 3 times 25 is right there, times 3 plus 25, throwing away the square root of 14, so that's s. T, I'll take this square root of the square and change square root of 14 into 25. That's a new twist that we didn't have before. Then, amazingly enough, s minus t has a factor of 13 in common with 611, in common with n, which is not an accident. If you ignore the question of how did I come up with this square, how did I look at a bunch of I plus 25j times I plus square root of 14j and come up with a square? If you just ask, okay, starting from the square, why does throwing away the square root of 14s and then changing that square root of 14 to 25 and so on, why does that produce an s minus t with a good chance of factoring n? In other words, why does it produce s squared being congruent to t squared mod n? That's easy to see from a ring homomorphism that maps z adjoins square root of 14. It takes all of the integers a plus root 14b and maps them to integers mod 611 by taking the square root of 14 and changing it to 25. This is a function, first of all, from the set of a plus b root 14s to the set 0 through 610 that takes a plus b root 14 and gives you as output a plus 25b mod 611. That function that I just wrote down, that is a ring homomorphism from z adjoint root 14 to z mod 611. It preserves addition, subtraction, multiplication, and so on. It's something that you can apply to equations that have addition, subtraction, multiplication, and you get the same equations for the outputs of the function. The reason that this is a ring homomorphism boils down to just the fact that 25 and square root of 14 are the same, mod 611. If you look for square roots of 14, then 25 is a square root of 14, mod 611. And that's enough to, starting from that equation, you can easily prove that the map I just said, a plus b root 14 mapping to a plus 25b mod 611, that is a I. That preserves multiplication along with the other ring operations. Of course, this 25 squared being 14 mod 611, in retrospect, 25 squared minus 14 is 611, and I just chose the 25 around the square root of 611, and then 14 popped up. Okay, starting from this ring homomorphism, let's apply that to this equation. And what do we get? We change all the square root of 14s to 25s. We get an equation mod 611. I've said at the end here, in z mod 611. That means if you do the arithmetic mod 611, you get the same results between 0 and 610. And, well, that follows from this and the fact that there's this map, which, again, boils down to 25 is the square root of 14. 25 is congruent to square root of 14, mod 611. Or if you like, you can work with ideals of the ring of integers of Q adjoint root 14 and take the kernels of these ring homomorphisms, kernels of ring homomorphisms, that's another way to say ideals. You can have an ideal generated by 25 minus root 14, and all of this work is factoring that ideal, which is tantamount to factoring 611. Anyway, applying that ring homomorphism, we get this equation of integers, mod 611, which is exactly s squared is congruent to t squared. Once you know that 611 divides s squared minus t squared, it's unsurprising to find a factorization of 611. There's a bunch of rings on this slide. I figured I would emphasize the algebra of which rings we're working with. The left column is just sort of for doing computations. It's convenient to have integer polynomials. Z adjoint x is all the polynomials. I've written it down here. I0 x to the 0 plus I1 x to the 1 plus etc. Formal expressions, just vectors I0, I1, etc. that are all all zero past some point and are all integers. That's z join x, where it's not just a set, it's a ring. It has addition and multiplication done in the way you expect with polynomials. That's z join x. And that's a convenient object for computers to work with the vectors I0, I1, etc. It's even more convenient sometimes to work with q join x, which changes the integers to rational numbers. The arrow going up from z join x to q join x is just the identity function. On the right side here, I've got the objects that, that really showed up inside the q adjoint root 14 sieve. In particular, z adjoint root 14 contains all of the elements, all of the square root of 14s and integers that I was working with. This is the smallest ring that contains the integers and contains square root of 14. If you like, you can also write down q adjoint square root of 14, change instead of integer plus integer square root of 14 with the usual operations on square root of 14, arithmetic and the real numbers, where I0 and I1 are integers. You can change z to q, change integers to rational numbers, and that gives you q adjoint square root of 14, which is the same as the number field, q adjoint with parentheses, that means the smallest field instead of the smallest ring. That's one of those number fields you were hearing about this morning, where there's all sorts of interesting things to say about the arithmetic, which we try to avoid in the number field sieve, but they inescapably come up, as we'll see in the final 20 minutes here. Anyway, it's sometimes convenient to work inside the whole number field there, or at least to have it in your head. But okay, all the elements that I wrote down before, minus 11 plus 3 root 14, that's inside this set of integer plus integer square root of 14. And then the critical ring homomorphism is this function from z adjoint square root of 14 to z mod 611, which, okay, that's just the usual integers 0 through 610 with arithmetic done mod 611. The function maps square root of 14 to 25. There's a unique ring homomorphism that maps this set to that set, which also takes square root of 14 to 25. And that's the critical one for applying to the squares that I get. Never mind the question of how I got those squares by writing down a bunch of I's and J's and inspecting them. This is why the squares produce an S squared component to T squared. All right, one more step up. For the number field sieve, generally, instead of working with quadratic fields, we work with arbitrary number fields. Instead of having x squared minus 14 being the polynomial defining your number field, you can have any polynomial f, any irreducible polynomial f. Actually, you can work with reducibles as well, but irreducibles, as far as we know, include all the best cases of the number field sieve. So let's just say f is an irreducible integer polynomial in one variable, x. And let's say m, instead of 25, we have a general m integer, which is a root of f modulo m. Think of m as being congruent to, later on I'll have alpha being a root of f. Well, modulo n, m is a root of f. So m is congruent to alpha. And you can make this all precise of what it means to have congruences here, but I'll just define congruences to be certain products as before. In general, let's say D is the degree of F. I'm going to give names to the coefficients. It's F is F0, X to the 0, plus F1, X to the 1, etc., up through FD. Irreducible polynomials don't have to be monic. I said here you can take it to be monic for simplicity. If you don't like all the FDs running around, just ignore them. Figure there'll be 1. I'll probably just say FD is 1, like later when I get FD alpha. Well, it's just alpha. But if you want to really optimize a number field, so if you do need to think about not just algebraic integers, roots of monic irreducible polynomials, but you also need to think about general algebraic numbers, roots of arbitrary irreducible polynomials. All right, so FD is in general not going to be 1, although it has been in all my examples. Alpha is something congruent to M modulo N. It's a root of F. Just pick some complex number alpha, which is a root of F. The number field you should be thinking of is Q adjoint alpha. I'll have a picture in a moment. The smallest field that contains this complex number alpha and the rational numbers q. Then it's easy to see that fd alpha is an algebraic integer. If you care about the fds, then you just go through this little calculation. Here's a monic polynomial that if you plug in fd alpha, then you get, this is a monic integer polynomial. If you plug in fd alpha, then you get 0, since f of alpha is 0. The fact that it's monic is, well, just look at the leading. And the fact that it's an integer polynomial, well, okay. If you care about the FDs, easy calculation. here's the picture of all the rings involved. Here's some inclusions, a subset of, well, there's the biggest set, Q adjoint alpha, the number field Q adjoint alpha, just like the quadratic fields this morning. It's the smallest field that has the rational numbers and has alpha in it. So explicitly, you can write each of those as rational R0 plus irrational R1 times alpha plus et cetera, up through the degree of alpha, d. You take alpha to the d minus 1 times some rational, and then this set is closed under multiplication, division by non-zero, addition, subtraction, 0, 1. So that is a field inside of which the set of algebraic integers plays the same special role as in the quadratic case. It's a very useful ring to play with, has all sorts of nice properties, a few of which I'll be saying as I finish off the description of the number field sieve. Inside of that, not necessarily the same as Z adjoint alpha. Even if FD is 1, this is not necessarily going to be O. Alpha could be twice the smallest alpha that would give you O. In fact, there's a lot of rings of integers which cannot be written as Z adjoint alpha for any alpha. But even if O can be written that way, this is not necessarily the same ring. It's smaller. And that difference is a little bit of an annoyance inside the number field sieve, and certainly for analyzing algebraically what's going on. But OK, this is a set. If you take I0 plus I1 alpha, let's just say FD is 1, plus et cetera through alpha to the d minus 1 times integers, add those together, this set is closed under multiplication and so on. This is a ring, subring of O, which is subring of the field Q adjoint alpha. And then this ring has a map. The construction of M and alpha as both being roots of F provides a ring homomorphism from this order. In general, orders won't be rank 2, they'll be rank D. Here's a finite rank Z module, which is a subring of Q adjoint alpha. And that order has a map to Z mod M, which takes alpha to M. Or being careful about the FDs in general, mapping FD alpha to FDM. And that's an easy algebraic calculation to see that there is a map. Instead of writing down I times I plus N or I plus 25J times I plus root 14J, in general what you write down is I minus JM times I minus J alpha, where I and J are relatively prime, otherwise it's easy to express them in terms of other J's, and J is positive. Actually, you can write down a few more congruences. You can also, instead of just having two variables, I and J, you could have I minus JX plus KX squared. There's lots of things you can do, but they don't really seem to speed up the number field sieve. The reason for these generalizations is to have useful parameters, have changes to your computations that actually let you speed up the number field sieve by choosing the parameters better. And, well, okay, it seems that maybe you could gain something by going beyond the I minus JM times I minus J alpha, but if there's a benefit there, it's so small that I'm not going to worry about it. The number field sieve, you can reasonably state as taking I minus JM times I minus J alpha, and hoping that by multiplying those together, you get a square. Let me again ignore the question of how you can recognize squares. Before, we did it by factoring into small primes, but supposing we've gotten beyond that, how does the relation between M and alpha and F and so on, how does that turn one of these products of I times I plus N, or here's the general expression, into a factorization of N? Well, you just apply the magic ring homomorphism to the squares you have, except there's a little obstacle here. Namely, the ring of integers is not necessarily that Z adjoint alpha or Z adjoint FD alpha. To try to turn it into a square, you can start multiplying it by the most obvious denominators that come to mind. If you have a square here in the field, Q adjoint alpha, alpha has a denominator of FD. Well, that's the part that's easiest to do. Just multiply the square by FD squared, and you get another square, which is guaranteed to be an integer, because FD times alpha and everything else inside that product, the product over all the I's and J's of I minus JM times I FD minus J alpha FD times another FD, it's still a square, and since FD alpha is an algebraic integer, this product is also an algebraic integer. Algebraic integers being closed under multiplication. All right, so there's that O again. We have a square there, but that's still not necessarily the ring that gives us a map to Z mod N. So we have to multiply further. And here's this nice fact that if you multiply by the square of what's called the different, which explicitly, I wrote down a polynomial G before, which is the same as F if FD is 1. Otherwise, it's just dividing by FD here, multiplying by FD there. If you take the derivative of that G, evaluated at FD alpha, usually this is F prime of alpha squared, then You take all of O, you take every algebraic integer, and if you have any algebraic integer, you just multiply even without the square by G prime of F D alpha, then you get an element of Z adjoint alpha. Multiply by F prime of, so in fact, if you take any element of O, multiply by F prime of alpha, it's an element of Z adjoint alpha. And here, okay, I've tweaked things by the FD, and I've also multiplied by a square because I want to have squares. I've started from a square in Q adjoint alpha, and by multiplying by some more squares, I get a square inside this ring that has a nice map. So I finally have, to summarize, I can actually compute a square root inside this ring. Once I've found a square, I can compute its square root. There's some polynomial R of the form I was saying before, a polynomial in FD alpha with D coefficients to play with. You can find a square root of G prime of FD alpha squared in general. That's the shape usually for FD being 1, it's F prime of alpha squared times the original product with, if FD is not 1, throw in some more FDs there. All right, so finally, I have an element of Z adjoint FD alpha, which is a square. And now I can apply this magic ring homomorphism that maps alpha to M, or in general FD alpha to FDM. And the final step, take the greatest common divisor of N with S minus T, where actually I think the way I've written it, it's looks like T minus S. R plays the same role here. Once you apply phi to it, that's the T. And then so this is like T minus S. This is like the square root of something minus the product of just the i's. And you can see that the things that I'm subtracting, if I square those and work backwards to this formula, applying phi to that formula, then I have two identical numbers modulo n. So finally, the number field sieve can compute a, oh yes, here's that formula with phi applied. Finally, the number field sieve can compute the greatest common divisor of n with two integers whose difference is, well, if you look at the square of the difference, it's 0 mod n, the s squared minus t squared, that's 0 mod n. If you take s minus t, it seems to have a 50% chance of factoring. Okay, there's still the question of how you find a square. And I still have a little bit of time. So how do you figure out, for a given I minus jm times I minus j alpha, like the I times 611 plus I before, how do you figure out whether one of those is a square or whether a product of a bunch of them is a square? What I did before was factored them into primes. And you can try to do the same thing here. Oh, I've written down here the setup again, ignoring what you do with the squares now. The focus is, how do you find these squares? Well, you start by writing down, instead of y squared numbers I, let's write down y squared numbers I. And starting from all those I minus, or sorry, y squared numbers I comma j, pairs I comma j. Starting from all those I minus jm times I minus j alpha, try to find numbers that factor into products of powers of small primes, primes less than or equal to y. And, well, the definition of smoothness for these number fields, for alphas, I minus j alphas, for I minus jm, it's just an integer, which, like I plus 25j, you just ask, is that a product of powers of primes less than or equal to y? If y is small, not too hard to figure out. For alpha, you use norms. And in terms of this function f that I started with, if you want to know, is I minus j alpha smooth, then you just write down f of I over j, clear the denominator of j by multiplying by j to the d, f is degree d. If that integer is smooth, then we declare I minus j alpha to be smooth. If both that integer and I minus jm are smooth, then we declare that the congruence I minus jm I minus times I minus j alpha, that congruence is y smooth. Once you have enough smooth congruences, then you can write down certain vectors, which I think I have enough time to state what those vectors are. You can write down certain vectors modulo 2, and then those vectors will tell you whether you have a square or not. Just like the exponent vectors of 2 to the something, 3 to the something, 5 to the something, etc., those somethings modulo 2 tell you whether you have a square in the integer. There's three pieces to the exponent vectors. The rational component is just a fancy way to say the integer primes that we were working with before, and that's what this whole slide is about, is that for each prime, p less or equal to y, you look at what's the power of p in I minus jm. I'm going to ignore I minus j alpha. I'm going to deal with that separately. That's the algebraic components. But for all of the I minus jms, for instance, all the i's or I plus 25 j's, or it's a p, this is one of the notations out there for the power of p, the exponent of p that divides this integer, I minus jm. That is a component of the vector that you write down for a pair I, comma, j, just like the 2 to the something. If p is 2 and you look at the power of 2 in I, then that is I. Well, it's a number you can write down, which tells you something about whether I is a square or not. It tells you whether 2 is to an even power or an odd power in I. In general, what's the power of p dividing I minus jm? That's the number you write down. Also, to take account of the fact that you might have negative integers, another twist is you keep generalizing the number field sieve. You often have negative numbers that you write down, and you just like have 2 to the some power, 3 to some power, etc. You can also have minus 1 to some power, 0 or 1, and that's an easy component to write down in your vectors. And, well, these, just like before, you can recognize squares in the integers just from these primes, and okay, for negative integers, also need this negative 1. If you have a product being a square, a product of integers, I minus jm being a square, product over a bunch of pairs I and j, then all of these vectors certainly will add to 0. If you have a square, it's certainly positive, and I'm staying away from 0 numbers here. My definition of smoothness excludes 0, if you think about it for a moment. If you have a positive number, then certainly minus 1 to the power of the sum of these vectors is going to be something positive, and therefore the vectors add up to 0 mod 2, and same for each of the primes, you get even numbers. You can not just, this is not just an if, but an if and only if, you can see from the vectors whether you have a square or not. For algebraic numbers, you have to do a little more work. For algebraic, for the I minus j alphas, to say whether that is a square or not, whether a product of those is a square or not, well, here's exactly the computation you do. You write down prime ideals, what are called first-degree prime ideals, in a very explicit way, as you write down prime numbers p. The prime ideals I have in mind are generated by p and r minus alpha. In general, if you have a prime number p less or equal to y, just looking at smooth numbers, I only care about primes less or equal to y, and let's just exclude stupidity by having p not divide fd, and also having p not divide the discriminant. You were hearing about quadratic field discriminants before. In general, it's easy to compute the discriminant of a polynomial and stay away from primes that divide it. R is an element of the finite field fp, an integer 0 through p minus 1, if you like, which is a root of f. These conditions are tantamount to saying that, ignoring the discriminant conditions, these are tantamount to saying that p and r minus alpha generate an ideal of the ring of integers of q join alpha. All right. Starting from that p, you can figure out, starting from that ideal, this pair of p and r, you can figure out the power of that ideal that divides an I minus j alpha. And I've written this down here in the usual algebraic language. What you do as a computation is you just take the same twisted f value at I over j, multiply by j to the d to make an integer, compute the power of p that divides that, assuming that I minus jr is a multiple of p. Easy computation to do, which algebraically says, here I've written down the prime ideal of O. Take p times O plus, all right, there's the fds I was neglecting before, fd alpha minus fdr times O, that is an ideal of O, which is prime, and it is possible to prove using some of the facts that I was stating before about how you choose I and j to be relatively prime. This is a way to say the GCD of I and j is 1. Using that, you can prove, and I'm not going to take the time to prove, that the power of this prime ideal dividing I minus j alpha is exactly the number that's easy to compute that I wrote down. Unfortunately, this does not quite tell you about squares in q adjoint alpha. Part of the problem is units that you were hearing about before. The units are not detected by powers of prime ideals. There's something where every prime ideal divides to a zero power. And, well, it's actually hard to compute units. You're going to hear a lot about that, which we work around in the number field sieve, work around the difficulty of computing units by writing down some more ideals and then computing Legendre symbols, Jacobi symbols. We compute whether I minus JR for appropriate choices of R is a square modulo P. You know that if you compute a Legendre symbol for an integer, then it tells you whether that integer is a square modulo the P. If you have an integer that's a square modulo a lot of p's, say 100 p's, it's almost certainly a square. Well, okay, this is kind of probabilistic intuitive, but certainly if you have a number that is a square, then it is guaranteed that these Legendre symbols, which I've written down how you compute those for number fields generally, it's guaranteed that those Legendre symbols will multiply to 1. If you multiply the product of I minus J alphas, then that's going to be a square modulo any prime ideal that you write down. If it's a square, it has to be a square mod anything. And that guarantees that these character components, these Legendre symbols, are going to add up to 0 mod 2, along with the powers of prime ideals. I said there are lots of fuzzy bits in this. There are lots of pieces where it's not exactly an if and only if. If you have a square, the vectors I wrote down are guaranteed to add up to 0 mod 2. But the opposite has lots of obstructions. Is it true, you can reasonably ask, that these vectors will detect squares for you? Certainly for integers it is. That's the easy case. But for algebraic numbers, is this product of I minus J alpha a square? Well, it is true that the ideal generated by this product, if you take the product of I minus J alpha and then multiply that by the ring of integers, O, then that is a square at each of the primes that doesn't divide the discriminant and the FD that cause certain annoyances. But, well, okay, what about those prime ideals? So saying square outside something means that if you ignore powers of primes that divide that thing, then it's a square. In other words, it's a square times some powers of a few primes, the primes that divide. Yes, prime ideals in this case. What about those prime ideals? And what if you do have a square ideal? What if you've dealt with the primes here? If you have a square ideal, then it's not necessarily true that the square root is going to be a principal ideal. If you want to have a square root of a number, then the ideal it generates is going to be a principal ideal generated by a single number. And, well, if you have a square ideal, its square root is not necessarily principal. If you have a principal square root of this square ideal, then, well, that square root, the square of that square root isn't necessarily going to be what you want. Even so, there's lots of obstructions for all the intuition that you have about positive integers that, well, you just factor them into primes, and that prime factorization easily tells you whether you have a square or not. It gets a lot more complicated. You can see unit groups showing up for, where do we have it here? If you have a square of an element that generates the square of an ideal, then, well, the element, the generators of an ideal can be multiplied by arbitrary units, and they're not necessarily going to be the single generator you started with. Same for the discriminant is an obstruction that shows up here, and the class group, which you'll hear more about computing from the quadraticates, is an obstruction that shows up here. We deal with all of these by observing that all of these are small obstructions. Quantitatively, you can analyze how big are the groups of ideals that and the groups of elements that you've written down here and do all sorts of analysis and convince yourself that, well, there's not a very big group of obstructions to finding a square inside a number field. And, well, there's a certain name that Henri Cohen has given to the obstruction group. It's called an FD discriminant of F Selmer group. And this is the sort of thing you say if you're trying to scare people away from something. And okay, you do enough work and you prove that, you actually have a small obstruction. There's a noticeable chance, in a sense I'll say in a moment, of a set of I's and J's, a product of I minus JM's, I minus J alphas, where those vectors all add up to 0 mod 2. There's a chance of that product giving you a square, a chance of finding a square in Q adjoint alpha. The chance is small in the sense that if you look at the chances 1 over 2 to the something, 1 over 2 to the fifth, 1 over 2 to the tenth, 1 over 2 to the thousand, the exponent isn't too big. It's maybe 1 over 2 to the thousand, which in this context is actually not too bad. You don't want to just write down random I minus JM's, I minus J alphas, and hope you get a square. Even if these vectors all add up to 0 mod 2, you still might have just a, say, 1 over 2 to the 100 chance of getting a square. But it's only 2 to the 100. And somehow putting in 100 characters experimentally, even we can prove some things here, putting in a few of those characters, a few of the Legendre symbols, makes up for the difference between whether something's a square on the top of this or a square on the bottom, whether an ideal is a square outside certain primes, outside certain prime ideals, or whether a particular generator turns out to be a square. And, well, okay, you can go through the analysis, go through the algebra, and convince yourself that, yeah, if we do enough characters, then if we write down, say, 100 characters, then that's going to be a pretty good chance of the final numbers we write down, the final elements of QHJ alpha, being squares, which, as I told you before, leads to a factorization, half the time a non-trivial factorization event. In practice, you throw all this away, and everything else I say about the number field sieve, about optimizing it, ignores all of the obstructions, ignores all the analysis, ignores the question of whether you can prove this, and just says, okay, go ahead and do it. Write down 100 characters, and if that's not enough, write down 200, 400, 800 characters, and if you find that, oops, you don't actually have a square, you try computing a square root, and oops, you can't find one, the number you've written down is not actually a square, then you write down a very big number and compute its square root in ways that I believe you've heard about already. Okay, it's an element of a number field instead of an integer, but same computation. If you find that, well, you don't have enough characters, you don't have a square, you just double the number of characters and try again. And there's, in practice, nobody's ever found that they need more than a few characters, more than a few hundred, to be precise. Another thing I could talk about, but I think I've run over time, is how you use sublattices for the number field sieve. And I think I'll just say that, well, as before, you can improve the number field sieve with sublattices, and it makes the smoothness chance of the numbers I minus JM and I minus J alpha that you write down, makes the smoothness chances go up conjecturally, experimentally. Actually doing the analysis, well, you have to write down some slightly more complicated expressions, which I've written down here. There's an extra divided by Q, just like before. So if you really want the final, how does the number field sieve work with all the tricks that people throw in, then the formulas are just a tiny bit more complicated, and there is this improvement, which you should have in mind, but I don't think I should go further over time. My last slide was about one other improvement you can do, which again makes things a little more complicated, but I think, okay, it's enough fun that it's worth spending just another minute. It's not that bad. Okay, instead of working with just one number field, you can work with two number fields, QHJ alpha, QHJ beta, and instead of just checking whether I minus JM and I minus J alpha are Y smooth, you can also check whether I minus J beta is Y smooth. And if either of these is Y smooth, then it gives you something useful. And okay, there's another level of complexity, which you can throw into the number field sieve. In my next talk, I'm going to focus on the problem of checking whether the integers that you see in all these computations, like this I minus JM and this I minus J alpha turned into an integer in an appropriate way, whether those integers are smooth. Checking that, I want to get the state of the art, not just say, well, we can do it in polynomial time in Y. I want to show you the best methods that we have for doing that computation. And for that, you can throw away all the number field sieve infrastructure, and you can say, okay, we've just got some integers, and how do we tell what the small factors of those integers are, which ones are completely factored into small primes. In the talk after that, I'm going to go back to some of the choices you make of how big Y is, and how big what polynomials you look at, how big those polynomials are, and try to get some idea of how fast the number field sieve is, which again doesn't require most of the algebra here, but I figure if anybody does want to know all the complications of what people throw into, what's computed in the number field sieve, here it is. All right, thank you for your attention. Question?
Is there a criterion for choosing a good alpha?
Is there a criterion for choosing a good alpha? Well, that gets into the whole question of how do you write down this F, which I'm going to address quite a bit in the third talk. So I'm going to try to say, all right, here's how you can write down polynomials. Here's a simple way of writing down F. You can just choose M and then make an appropriate F. But then you start seeing lots of variability in the number field sieve time. And yeah, there's a lot that we have to say. So that's one of the main topics, actually the biggest topic in my third talk, is how do we figure out what some good Fs are, what some good alphas are. And you have a huge amount of flexibility in how you choose these number fields, how you choose alpha and F for the number fields.
Along those lines, is there an advantage to using like certain classes of irreducible polynomials, say like Eisenstein or or cyclotomic polynomials, or is it better just use random polynomials?
It's hard to use a cyclotomic polynomial because then you can't find the m. And
okay.
In general, if you have some structure for your f, then it gets really difficult to find the m, because computing a root of f, if you first chose an f in some nice way, and then you try to figure out an m that's a root of f, then that root finding problem is equivalent to factorization. That's just as hard as factoring. If you, for instance, want to compute roots of quadratic polynomials, that's just as hard as factoring, provably. So if you have a fast method to figure out m given a nice f, then given an input f, then that will tell you a way to factor m. You don't even need the number fields. So what people have to do is choose an m, and then it's much easier to see what the f's could be, but those won't have the nice structures that you're saying, like could it be a cyclotomic polynomial, for example?
Or
the answer is no.
It's hard. You know a lot more structure and for cyclotomic, you know, then learning of integers is just C join script.
That's right. The comment was that for cyclotomic fields, it's relatively easy to write down, for instance, the ring of integers, and also the obstructions I was saying before, the things that you start hearing about for quadratic fields, like the unit group, the class group. How you compute these things is actually pretty easy for certain classes of fields, and then you can take advantage of that in the number field sieve. It slightly speeds things up. For some n's, if n has a special structure, sometimes you can look at n and see, aha, for a particular m and a particular f, just because n happens to be, say, 2 to the 5, 12 plus 1, you can easily see that, oh, if you choose m to be, I think in the computation somebody did, it was something like 2 to the 80 or so, maybe a little bigger. In any case, they had some particular, actually, I think, beep, beep, was that me? Okay. I know I'm over time, but it's questions at this point, so we'll ask them. For 2 to the 5, 12 plus 1, you can write that as m to the 5th, plus 8 if you multiply it by 8. So if you multiply by 8, you get 2 to the 5, 15 plus 8. And that is m to the 5th plus 8, where m is 2 to the 103. And then that x to the 5th plus 8, okay, not quite cyclotomic, but it's a Coomer extension. That's almost as easy to deal with as cyclotomic fields. You can easily figure out, for instance, the class group, the ring of integers. And, well, when you do that, you can take advantage of that in the number field sieve. And it speeds it up a little bit. More importantly, it also makes such a small alpha, such a small f, that the size of the numbers you want to have being smooth becomes smaller. But for most numbers n, if you have a number n, some of you might have heard that the special number field sieve, the number field sieve is more effective at factoring particular numbers, like say 2 to the 5, 12 plus 1, it's really happy with because of that special structure. But most numbers n don't have that structure. You can count how many n's have the structure and see it's not a significant proportion of the numbers that we want to factor. So it's something useful to think about, certainly, but for most n's it doesn't work. And my focus in these talks is what's the fastest way to, for the first three talks, is what's the fastest way to factor some RSA module, some number that somebody's chosen to be as hard as possible to factor. And for those, you're not going to find, say, cyclotomic structure. Any more questions? All right, well, thank you for your attention.
Thank you for coming to the